Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Presidential hopefuls sparred over Iraq as Barack Obama set the stage for a high-profile trip to Europe and the Middle East. Both candidates courted Hispanic and Black voters at the annual meetings of La Raza and the NAACP. President Bush held a press conference in which he tried to calm fears about the economy and urged Congress to lift a ban on offshore oil drilling. And former Vice President Al Gore called on Americans to abandon fossil fuels within a decade. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Eamon Javers of Politico, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
Karen Tumulty, next week you're going to be reporting on what you've called Senator Obama's overseas audition. Where is he going to be going? What's he going to be doing?
Well, I can tell you exactly where his plane is going, but the campaign has been a little bit sketchy on details, particularly on what is expected to be a sort of diversion from the trip to Iraq and Afghanistan. But basically, the official part of the campaign part of the trip begins Monday in Jordan. From there, Senator Obama spends a couple of days in Israel. And from there, he goes to Germany, which is where he's going to have his one big public event of the trip, which is a big public speech in Berlin somewhere. And then after that, Paris and London.
Angela Merkel doesn't seem too thrilled to have him there at the Brandenburg Gate, Jerry.
No, I think the Germans got a little upset about the notion that their Brandenburg Gate or the whole setting was going to be used as a campaign prop, and I think found the Obama campaign was perhaps a little presumptuous to just assume they could use that setting. It set off an interesting debate within Germany between Angela Merkel and some Obama supporters, and it became kind of a domestic football. I suspect that will all have died away by the time Senator Obama gets there. And whatever the setting, it's going to be a big moment in the campaign.
What are the risks, Eamon?
Well, the risks are that you've got all three network newscasts traveling with Barack Obama to Europe. It's, on the one hand, his chance to appear presidential and to sort of echo in the steps of Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy, who've also spoken in high-profile settings in Germany. But on the other hand, all that attention comes a lot of pressure. And if he makes a gaffe or he fouls up something or he gets a statistic wrong or anything at all, people are going to jump all over that.
You know, what the campaign is really hoping is that this will be seen as one of these pivotal moments where Obama sort of clears the threshold of acceptability on the question of whether this very young man with so little experience is acceptable to most Americans as a commander-in-chief. Right now, he's leading John McCain in the polls. He's running ahead of John McCain in the handling of just about every issue except in the latest Washington Post poll. He's running 24 points behind John McCain on the question of whether he would be a capable commander-in-chief.
Now, this is also a tricky area for Senator Obama for another reason. If he's going to be in Europe, he has to be careful not to be seeming to criticize the U.S. in any way while he's in Europe, which is hard to do because one of the things you want to do is critique Bush administration foreign policy while you're in Europe. But it's tricky to do that without appearing to criticize the country. And, you know, there are a lot of Obama critics waiting to hear him say something that can be labeled as unpatriotic. So I think that's another tricky balancing act he's going to have to do on this trip.
Earlier in the week, he laid out his vision for Iraq and Afghanistan. What's he saying, Karen?
Well, there was not a lot new in the speech, but basically he described the Iraq war, as he has in the past, as a diversion from what he says is the real war on terror, which is the one that is happening in Afghanistan. He pledged to send in more troops. It was interesting, by the way, because that speech was followed almost immediately by a speech from Senator McCain, where he, too, pledged to send in more troops from Afghanistan, although the question with Senator McCain was, where would these troops be coming from? Because he is not committed to a drawdown of troops from Iraq.
That, I think, is the key difference at this point in many ways between the McCain approach and the Obama approach. I think Senator Obama is positing a direct correlation between a number of troops in Iraq and the number of troops the U.S. can commit to Afghanistan. And Senator McCain is essentially saying we have to do both. We don't have to slight one to do more in the other. And it's interesting to see what people in the U.S. Army might think about that. That's really one of the core debates right now, because I think everybody agrees, and Senator Obama has really probably come close to admitting that the surge helped the security situation in Iraq. The question is really much more now, and this is better for the campaign in some ways, where to from here, as opposed to a backward-looking argument.
And the interesting thing about this moment is we've got sort of the dovetailing of a number of interesting trend lines here. One is the relative success of the surge in Iraq in limiting the violence there. The other one is you've got the Iraqi government making a lot of noises about asking the Americans to leave at some point. Instead of just an indefinite occupation, the government there itself is beginning to assert itself a little bit and say, well, there's got to be a time frame for American troops to leave. And you've got Barack Obama having suggested and then stepping back from that suggestion that he might revisit his pledge to set a definite timetable for withdrawing troops from Iraq. So all of those things indicate that the Obama point of view on Iraq and the McCain point of view on Iraq might be getting closer and closer, ironically, as we get closer to this election because of the facts on the ground.
Aitman, as you said, there's going to be an awful lot of attention on Barack Obama with these three network news hosts going along with him, each doing an interview along the way. What happens to John McCain while all this is going on abroad?
Well, the McCain people are trying not to whine about this in public as much as they can, but they do have a legitimate gripe here, which is that if the networks are paying this much attention to what is, remember, what is a campaign event for Barack Obama. This is not a head of state traveling to Europe. This is a campaign rally in Europe. They say, well, wait a second, why aren't we getting that kind of coverage for our candidate? This is just unfair on the part of the media. And that's a complaint that will gather legs and gather steam, I think, as the week goes on and we see the kind of attention that this Barack Obama trip is going to get.
What kind of attention did John McCain get when he went to Colombia, Karen?
Not a lot, actually. And that, you know, would be one of the complaints they have, although, as I recall, they did not exactly encourage a lot of press attention to this trip. But again, you know, a trip to Colombia, even though it is the subject of a free trade controversy at the moment, is not quite of the, you know, sort of planting yourself, you know, front and center in an American security strategic interest as going to Europe and the Middle East.
Is this a good idea, this trip, Jerry Seid?
I don't know. It's certainly an unusual idea. I mean, it is very unusual to be at this stage in a general election campaign and to have a candidate who's essentially the presumed nominee step aside and spend an entire week overseas. It's the sort of thing that candidates tend to do a year ahead of time, not a few months before the general election. It tells you a lot about the perceived need in the Obama campaign to address the question that Karen was referring to earlier. Is he a commander-in-chief? Does he have the experience? Are we comfortable? I think it's, in a way, an implicit acknowledgement by the Obama campaign. They're not sure they've made Americans comfortable with the idea of him as a commander-in-chief. And so by the very timing of the event, it becomes risky.
You know, as much as we are all going to probably fall into the trap, though, of covering the stagecraft of all this, which we will. I mean, I will probably plead guilty here in advance.
Because you're leaving on Sunday, are you
that's
not?
That's right.
Yes.
The fact is, though, that these trips can be very important. And I would harken back to one that then Governor George Bush took in, I believe it was 1998, a trip to Israel. And he has often spoken about a helicopter ride he took with Ariel Sharon, where he was able to see from the air just exactly how small and vulnerable Israel really was. And he said that for, you know, for a boy from Texas to see that, that this a tiny place really shaped his thinking.
And it's my understanding that Barack Obama is leaving today. Now, what does that augur for this weekend, Karen?
Well, I think one of the interesting things to look at are the two traveling companions he has chosen for this congressional delegation. One is Chuck Hagel, who has been a critic of the war, even though he voted for the authorization of the invasion, a conservative Republican, to sort of try to give a sense that this is a real bipartisan endeavor. The second choice is Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. This will be Senator Reed's 12th trip to Iraq. And he, unlike most members of Congress, when he goes, he normally goes by himself. He gets out of the green zone. He goes and talks to mid-level commanders, grunts on the ground, and writes these incredibly detailed reports from his trips when he comes back. And so Senator Reid, who's a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says that is exactly what they are going to be trying to do on this trip, is getting out of the official to coin O'Reilly's phrase, spin zone.
Now, do you assume then, Jerry Seib, he's going to be in Iraq/Afghanistan, perhaps over this weekend?
I think it's possible, maybe likely. You know, the way these congressional delegations, and that is what this is, it's a presidential campaign trip, but this part of it is really a congressional trip. They don't tend to announce timing in advance for security reasons, and you tend to discover they're underway when the principals land. Just to underscore what Karen said about Jack Reed, I think it's a very interesting choice because, you know, there is a possibility that Jack Reed might be on that vice presidential shortlist. I mean, he's a West Point graduate, an Army veteran who voted against the war in Iraq, but has spent a lot of time working on ways to get it right in Iraq since the war began.
And some people have actually talked about Chuck Hagel as a possible vice presidential
a Republican
candidate. And we'll take a short break. Do join us. 800-433-8850. Welcome back to this week's Friday News Roundup with Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Eamon Javers, he's correspondent for Politico. We've just gotten an email from John in Chesterfield, Missouri, who says John McCain's trip to Iraq with Lieberman got a lot of coverage. Eamon.
Well, John McCain has traveled overseas, and he went to Colombia as well. But the scale of the coverage, I think, is going to be dwarfed by what we're going to see here with Barack Obama. I mean, all three network newscasts are going to be broadcasting live from Obama sites, and those are campaign rallies. I mean, we can't underscore this enough. They might be officially trying to pitch part of this as a congressional delegation, but this is entirely a campaign exercise for Barack Obama.
And here's an email from Christopher in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, who says, I don't understand why it's so important for presidential candidates to take these international trips. The American public is not going to vote based on how many trips they take overseas. There's nothing they will learn now. They cannot learn when they become president, and no other country will decide our election. Jerry.
Well, there's a certain large element of truth to all that. I think the reverse argument is partly political, partly substantive. The political argument is that the Obama campaign was already confronting a fairly regular critique from the McCain side and Republicans in general that ran along the lines of, well, he hasn't been to Afghanistan ever, and when was the last time he was in Iraq? So how does he know? They can now counter that. And, you know, in the fall when there's a debate and Iraq comes up, Barack Obama will now be able to say, well, when I was there 2 months ago, I saw this. And, that, you know, in symbolic terms, that matters. Substantively, you know, there is something to be said for being on the ground and hearing soldiers and civilians in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. There is some element of understanding that comes from that, I think.
But I also think, and I was talking to Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, about this just this week, when voters are trying to assess a person as a potential commander-in-chief, it's not just whether they can answer a, you know, 10-question multiple-choice quiz on foreign policy. There's also a sense you get when you see him standing shoulder to shoulder with world leaders, the people who he's going to be dealing with. You get a sense of sure-footedness. You get a sense of a general philosophy and a comfort level. And I think that's one thing that Americans are going to be trying to see if they see in Barack Obama.
And one thing to watch for here in terms of the huge political upside for Barack Obama is look for the crowds in Europe. I mean, Barack Obama is hugely popular in Europe. When you talk to Europeans, they say that folks there are following this campaign in ways they've never seen before. So I think you might see huge numbers of people in the streets for Obama. That would be a good thing because it will demonstrate his popularity in the world. I would imagine his critics will say, hey, wait a second, these Germans don't get to decide an American election.
And at the same time, coming on the eve of the trip to Europe and to the Middle East is the cover of the New Yorker magazine, which depicts Barack Obama, his wife Michelle, fist joining as Islamic extremists. What did you think of that?
It was pretty surprising. It was clearly parody.
David Remnick says you got to take the humor. Did you get the humor?
You know, I mean, I would never argue for censorship, but I do think that, you know, for a Midtown Manhattan audience, perhaps this was clearly parody. But the fact is, this New Yorker cover was not just on the newsstand. It was all over cable TV. And, you know, if judging by what you see on the internet, there are some Americans who wouldn't see that as parody at all.
Who buy into the notion of these two people as Muslims.
Yeah, you know, look, I love The New Yorker. I think David Remnick is a genius. That said, this came out of totally out of left field. And I think it was, they're saying that it's satire and it's parody, but if you have to spend an entire week explaining a joke, then it wasn't a very funny joke in the first place. And, you have to question to the extent to which something is parody. If you just say a racist statement, for example, is that parodying racism or is that racism itself? I mean, you have to ask that question. And that's what they did here. There was almost no indication here that this was anything but a critique of Obama if you looked at the cartoon.
All right, let's move on here. President Bush on Monday lifted an executive ban on offshore oil drilling. What are the chances, Jerry, that the Congress is likely to follow suit?
It doesn't look very likely. I actually thought for a while, you know, a couple of weeks ago, that maybe the sentiment was building to reverse course, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And certainly the leadership in the Democratic leadership in Congress does not seem inclined to go in that direction. So what you're left with is a move by President Bush that was largely symbolic and partly political to make it clear to Americans who do think there should be more drilling off America's coasts that the reason that's not happening is Democrats, not Republicans. That much was accomplished. I suspect that's about all that will be accomplished in the short run.
Yeah, I agree. It does give the Republicans a talking point. I don't think anybody expected the ban to be lifted. But this is one that I think could resonate, and in part because I don't think the Democrats have really very clearly articulated a strategy for dealing with gas prices in the short to mid-range time frame.
Well, of course, you've got Al Gore, who made his speech yesterday calling on Americans to give up carbon-based electricity fuel within the next 10 years. How realistic?
It's not realistic at all.
Why not?
Because you'd have to fundamentally change the entire way the U.S. economy works, and that's been built over several hundred years, and you're not going to undo it in a decade. You're just not. And even Al Gore acknowledges that. I mean, he says that part of what he sees his role here is to push the envelope of the political space for the arguments that McCain and Obama can make on in terms of the environment. So Al Gore is trying to run way out there, wide to the left on this issue. But he puts it in very, very stark terms. I mean, he says the fate of the nation is at stake here and the fate of humanity itself is at stake here. It's hard to ignore that kind of rhetoric.
I think the political divide here is kind of interesting. It may be beneficial for Republicans. Republicans tend to stress short-term things that can be done in the near term and the medium term right now to fix the problem of $4 a gallon gasoline. Democrats tend to talk more about long-term solutions that will end this addiction to hydrocarbons. And both are probably necessary, and I think most people in America would buy into both ideas. The problem for Democrats is that if you're talking to people who fear losing their jobs in Ohio or Michigan, they want to know what's going to happen in the next year, not what ought to be done 10 years from now. And the McCain camp senses this, and they're moving in to take that opportunity away.
It's interesting. He said, citing some scientists' estimates, that enough solar energy falls on the surface of the Earth in 40 minutes to meet the world's energy needs for a year, and that the winds that blow across the Midwest every day could meet the country's daily electricity needs. Karen.
But that kind of conversion goes exactly the opposite direction of the political winds in this country, because even Vice President Gore himself acknowledged that the short-term impact would be a dramatic rise in the cost of energy as we would be converting to these systems.
To capture all of the sun's energy that lands on planet Earth, you'd have to have solar panels covering all of planet Earth to do that. So that's just not a realistic estimate of how much energy you can get from solar. That said, there are probably ways to increase the amount of energy that we do get from solar and from wind without damaging the environment. And clearly, both McCain and Obama are saying that we need to do those. Even McCain says global warming is real and we want to invest more in solar and wind and other alternative fuels. That's somewhat of a shift for Republicans. They haven't been saying that they haven't been hitting that nail very hard in past years.
So the question becomes, is Al Gore trying to inject himself into this political campaign, Jerry?
I don't think so. I mean, if Al Gore wanted to do that, he could be the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, or at least say that he wanted to be. I mean,
he said he doesn't want to be.
He's saying it in as many ways as he can think of now that people have started to speculate. So, I think in a way he is inserting himself into the campaign debate, but I don't think he's inserting himself into the campaign per se, and I guess I see a distinction.
All right. One of the top issues in this year's campaign is clearly the economy. And Ben Bernanke warned this week about higher inflation. So what does the Fed do? Does it fight inflation? Does it try to keep interest rates low? Does it raise them? What does it do, Eamon?
Well, historically, inflation is a very, very bad thing, and Ben Bernanke is keeping a close eye on it. He's worried that inflationary indicators are increasing, and that the Fed might have to do something here. But it's a very, very touchy thing, because raising interest rates could be bad for the macro economy, and because you've got about five or six moving parts in the economy right now that are all very touchy and very delicate, including the concern that there might be some kind of meltdown at Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which underlie the U.S. mortgage market. That's sort of the doomsday machine of the U.S. economy. If those two were to fall apart, which no one expects right now, it could have dramatic ramifications across the planet.
Well, and one problem here is that what is driving inflation at this point to around 5% year-over-year numbers, which is twice as high as the Fed would like to see, are things that are beyond the Fed's control. Oil prices, for instance. So while Bernanke says that this is a top priority for the Fed, this is one problem that the Fed doesn't have the levers to deal with.
Well, it's sort of an exquisite dilemma for the Fed. If they raise interest rates further, which a lot of people thought until a few weeks ago was likely as the year went on, they will, in fact, slow down the inflationary pressures. They will actually probably decrease the cost of oil because they will both slow down the American economy and drive up the value of the dollar, which will make oil actually decline in price. And those would probably be good things, but at the cost of slowing down the economy further. So where is the balance? If you, on the other hand, don't raise interest rates further, you let oil price increases continue to move through the economy. Rate prices go up, inflation increases, and then you're in a real jam. So I think the formula is probably stand pat for a while.
But let me understand this oil crisis, going back to the president's asking for lifting the ban on offshore drilling. You've got some 88 million acres already licensed for oil drilling in this country. What is the problem of using those that are already given over to that purpose?
Well, there's no problem in using them, and I think the argument of Democrats is that the federal government has been lax in compelling energy companies to actually exploit the energy that's under lands that they have leased. The counterargument is that if the oil under those acres was actually easy and economic to get at, it would have been extracted by now or would be being drilled for at this moment.
But how do we know that offshore drilling is going to be any easier than what they've already got?
Well, I think there's probably a wider sense of consensus that there is, in fact, oil to be found in meaningful amounts offshore. The question is it enough to run the environmental risks of going to get it? I don't think the question of whether there's substantial amount of oil in some offshore tracts is really in dispute. The question is it enough to make the effort worthwhile?
There's another problem, too, which is that refineries are already running at pretty close to capacity as well. It isn't just the crude oil supply that's at issue here in determining oil prices.
Well, and the irony here is that we actually saw oil drop in value this week. The price of oil went down earlier in the week, went down about $2 a barrel on concerns of the U.S. economy. So as much as we say that the oil price increases are hurting the economy, it's actually the troubled economy this week and bad news from the U.S. that triggered a decline in oil values around the world, because that indicates that consumption of oil will go down in this country too.
It's possible this was the week in which this oil bubble burst. I mean, you have had meaningful drops in the price of oil this week. And almost
a wild ride in the stock market.
Right. And the drop in the price of oil was almost entirely related to what people thought the state of the U.S. economy was, which is to say, to the extent the economy is booming, people burn more oil. To the extent the economy is receding, people burn less oil. That's the market judgment right now, which is that the economy is slowing down, and maybe that puts an end to the speculative fever on oil prices.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And before we go to the phones, I want to ask about what happened this week. The president claims of executive privilege in denying a request by Congress to release FBI reports about the leak of a CIA officer. And we know she was Valerie Plame's identity. Amen.
Well, what's going on here, I think you have to interpret this as a political attempt to sort of run out the clock by the Bush administration. I mean, Henry Waxman is the House committee chairman in Congress who is demanding to see these records, and the Bush administration is saying, no, it's executive privilege. We're just not going to release the documents to you. The administration knows that a fight over executive privilege can take a lot longer than the amount of time that remains in the administration's tenure, and that after the administration is gone, there won't be a whole lot of political effort to find these documents because there'll be a new administration and a new president to pick on.
Well, of course, the principle behind the idea of executive privilege is that the president ought to be able to talk to his aides in candor and get candid assessments. And
that's what Mukasey is saying.
Well, he is saying that within these interviews are some descriptions of conversations that the president had with his aides. But I've got to agree, this is the whole executive privilege debate has turned into sort of a hall of mirrors, because now Chairman Waxman is arguing that Mukasey shouldn't even be ruling on this because he was the subject of the subpoena and that he's got a conflict of interest. So the whole thing, or actually it was Senator Leahy, I believe, who made that argument. But whatever, I think this is something that is likely to be in the courts long after George Bush is out of office.
And now Charlie Rangel is in a little difficulty, Jerry's side.
He is on two fronts. An assertion that he has improperly benefited from four rent-controlled apartments in Manhattan, or actually in Harlem, and that violates the city's standards for rent control apartments, and also that he used congressional stationery to raise money for an institute named in his honor at a university. And so all of a sudden, Charlie Rangel, who's been on the offensive a lot, was on the defensive this week and not very happy about it.
Yeah, and this was great investigative reporting by both the New York Times and the Washington Post, which brought out these stories. And the interesting thing with the Rangel financial solicitations is that he's soliciting money from people, companies who are regulated by or affected dramatically by his actions as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. So he's asking for money from the very same people who have a lot at stake in his committee. It's very hard if you're solicited for money from a Charlie Rangel with that much power over the economy to say no to him.
This, by the way, led to something that I think that I have never seen before in all my years in Washington, which is that Charlie Rangel then filed an ethics complaint against himself so that this would go to the ethics committee, and he hopes to get a clean bill of health.
Karen Tumulty, she's a reporter for Time Magazine. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. We'll take your questions, comments, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the American College of Medical Genetics, ACMG, translating genes into health at acmg.net. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. In a policy reversal, the Bush administration sends a top diplomat to Geneva to discuss Iran's nuclear weapons program. Suicide bombers kill dozens in Iraq, and the U.S. abandons an outpost in Afghanistan where 9 American soldiers were killed. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to go to the phones for our Friday News Roundup. First to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Howard.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm following up on what I think some other of your previous emailers had wondered. I'm curious about the media coverage of Senator Obama's trip to the various places he's going in. And I imagine some of you are going. The question is, why are the CBS, the major networks sending their anchors to this? While John McCain's trip to Colombia was covered by correspondents or mostly ignored. And that goes on to what I perceive, and this goes both ways, because I used to be a reporter, and you try to hide your political agendas on this. But, Newsweek, might as well be called Obama Week, with cover after cover. Time did profiles on this as well. And I know we're all, I realize none of you are media critics like a Howard Kurtz. I'm just curious as to your perception. Do you find the coverage balanced, or do you find this slanting one way or the other? Both sides.
All right. Thanks for calling. Jerry Zipe, what's your reaction?
Well, look, you just simply can't compare a trip in which the three network anchors are going to the kind of coverage John McCain got in Columbia. It's just on its face, there's no comparison. Now, the question is, why is that? And networks are interested in ratings. They obviously sense a lot of public interest in the Obama campaign, which I think is demonstrably the case, which doesn't mean it's adulation of Obama, but curiosity about Obama. And, I think that's justifiable. I do think the McCain people will have, and I'm quite sure will be articulating, a legitimate complaint that balance requires attention to both candidates, and I suspect there'll have to be some adjusting along those lines.
Let's go now to Chicago, Illinois. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Hey, as a red state guy out here from Indiana, I find some humor in McCain is kind of getting his comeuppance. He made such a big deal about Obama not traveling, not having experience, not being out in the world and doing this stuff. And then when it does happen, it's kind of like, well, why is this getting all this attention when, Senator McCain kind of brought this attention on himself?
Karen.
Well, I've also, that's occurred to me as well. And the same sort of thing with the criticisms. Originally, the Republicans and Senator McCain were accusing Obama of being inflexible on his Iraq position. They're saying, why are you even making this trip if you've already made up your mind? And yet, when Obama drops even a hint that he might think about those timetables, at least, reconfiguring them a bit on the basis of advice from the commanders, which, by the way, is nothing new for him to have said, they're suddenly saying, see, he doesn't stand for his principles. So I think they're trying to come at him from any direction they've got.
Well, there's another irony here, too, which is that John McCain was the one who, since 2000 on, was always characterized as a creature of the media and an invention of the national press that loved him so much. So it's ironic that the shoe seems to be on the other foot. So
and
it all goes around,
Yeah, another email saying, didn't the McCain people feed the media by counting of days since Obama had been in Iraq?
Yeah, and look, they are sophisticated people. They knew that complaining that Obama hadn't been in Iraq was going to have the effect of sending Obama to Iraq at some point, but they made the calculation that they could ding him on it for as many days until he actually went there, and then they changed their complaint when the time came, and that's what they're going to be doing.
Here's an email from Monica in Gaithersburg, who says the first 5 minutes of the show and all the guests are criticizing Obama one way or the other. Can you have a more balanced panel? It's unfair and not what I expect from this show. I'm disappointed. I hope this is mentioned during the listeners' comment section. And there you have it, Monica. Anybody want to come in?
I thought the media was supposed to be in the tank for Obama. Wasn't that the criticism?
All right. Let's go to Kevin in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to one of your guests who said that Gore's vision of a carbon-free future is not possible. There's actually a scientific study by Dr. Arjun Makajani. It's called Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free by 2050. And it's a roadmap to U.S. energy policy. And it shows that wind power, solar power, and dramatic increases in efficiency are the way to go. And we can get away from the risks and the costs of fossil fuels as well as nuclear power.
I think there are a lot of possibilities out there, Kevin. The question becomes, can it be accomplished within Vice President Gore's time frame?
Well, this study looks at the year 2050, so there is a difference in time frame, but it's certainly doable, and we have to start right away because we're entering into dangerous climate crisis conditions.
Indeed. Thanks for calling. Let's go to another caller on the climate. John, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. The issue of solar power, I think, was glossed over a little bit. There's a technology that's been running in California since the 1980s called solar thermal CSP, where you use mirrors to heat oil or water. You're not using a solar panel. It's a different solar technology. If you took 10% of the federal land in Nevada, you could power the entire USA. That is being glossed over, and it's also being held up because the renewable energy tax credits are being held up. And there's a company called OSRA, there's a company called eSolar, and there's companies in Spain and the Middle East all putting in thermal solar power. So this could be done, and it only takes 2 years to build a power plant. It doesn't take 10 or 20 years.
John, I appreciate your call. And here is an email from Dale in Thurman, North Carolina, who says it's about time someone laid down the gauntlet. If our nation put half the effort into solving our energy problem as we do in whining about not being able to solve it, we would be able to reach this goal easily. There are many possible solutions that aren't getting any press, much less subsidies, including algae-based biofuels that have the potential to produce 100% the fuel per acre of cellulosic biofuels and are carbon neutral. Lots of ideas out there and people really looking for answers. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, everyone. I enjoy this show.
Thank you.
I had a comment about the New Yorker cover.
Sure.
I did not particularly care for it, even though I understood it for the audience that was being targeted. Of course, everyone in America does not believe that image. It's just a satire. I think, however, the image would have been more effective and less explaining would have had to have been done if they had had that image drawn to sort of be a dream coming out of the mind of Jesse Helms. That would have, I think, starkly put everything into sharp focus that would have been very unambiguous.
Kevin, you ought to write a letter to David Remnick at The New Yorker and express your vision. I think it would have clarified a lot. What do you think, Jerry?
Well, I think, as we were discussing earlier, the question was how many people instantly saw it as parody? And the second question was that appropriate parody? But I think you start with the question of what was the statement that was being attempted, and if people didn't get it as a satire instantly, then there was a problem with it, and I think that's what came across.
Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I had a comment. Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. One of your guests said that Obama was being presumptuous by wanting to speak at the Brandenburg Gate. And I think I had heard that he was invited by the mayor of Berlin. I think that speaks to the domestic politics in Germany, where Merkel may not like him, but the mayor of Berlin, and in fact, as someone pointed out, the majority of more Germans approve of Obama, they say, than approve of their own leader. So I think it's it's good to correct that image that Obama was presumptuous and invited himself.
And I'm glad you called, Eamon.
Well, there is a tussle going on in Germany between the mayor of Berlin, who's more liberal, and Merkel, who's more conservative, over what the appropriate role for Obama is. The local government in Berlin has been very much in favor of Barack Obama coming. Now, I don't know the chronology exactly of whether he got an invitation before he announced his intention to go there or whether he announced his intention and then the invitation came. But clearly, the local government in the city of Berlin is enthusiastic about Barack Obama.
Wasn't there some question of hypocrisy about Angela Merkel's objections, since when George Bush was running for president, she, Angela Merkel, wrote an op-ed piece in an American newspaper.
Right, although she was the opposition leader at that point, and so I think she would argue probably it was a different circumstance. But it also gets to another point here, which we didn't make, which is that she's been on good terms with the Bush administration,
exactly.
Wants to stay on good terms with the Bush administration, probably does not want a trip by Barack Obama to interfere with her ability to get along with a Republican administration while it's still in office.
Karen. Although, if I had to guess right now, I would guess, because Obama had people in Berlin looking for alternate sites earlier this week, that this speech, if I had to guess, is not going to happen at the Brandenburg Gate.
Would you agree with that, Eamon?
I think Obama's people might want to duck this criticism at this point, this issue of whether it's presumptuous to stand in the same place that Ronald Reagan stood and said, tear down this wall, when you're not the president yet, you're just a candidate. That's a question that maybe by choosing another location, he'd be able to avoid that altogether.
Let's go now to Jay in Madison, Connecticut. Jay, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to comment on John McCain's assertion that because Obama it hasn't been to Iraq recently and has never been to Afghanistan, by that logic, McCain not having gone to, say, Cuba would disqualify him from being able to engineer any policy regarding dealing with that island nation?
Well, there's a certain logic to that, obviously. I think Iraq is probably a special case because there has been a fair amount of debate in Congress about what are the conditions on the ground in Iraq, and let's go find out. And a sense that there was a gap sometimes between improvements in the security situation on the ground and the perception of that security situation that had taken hold back in the U.S. So I guess I think that there's a logical point that the caller makes. I think Iraq may be in a slightly different category just because of the way the debate internally in the U.S. has evolved over the last 3 or 4 years.
What about both McCain and Obama speaking before La Raza and the NAACP?
Well, poor John McCain had to follow Barack Obama at the NAACP earlier this week. I mean, that's a very difficult act to follow the first African-American presumptive nominee of a party when you're a white guy. Now, McCain was able to diffuse some of the tension there by sort of opening with a joke and sort of praising Obama and saying, don't tell him I told you this, but I think he's great, and I'm proud of the country that we are where we are, that we have this situation, but I hope his success doesn't continue any further. So McCain handled it. And then on the other hand, you had Obama, who has tensions of his own this week because we've had Jesse Jackson getting in some trouble calling Obama names on television that in a moment where he didn't know he was on television. You see this tension.
I find it hard to believe that. I really do. You know, Jesse Jackson is a very savvy person, knows about technology.
He's been on TV a lot.
He's been on TV a great deal. I just found it difficult to believe he did not know his comments might be picked up. Karen.
Well, if this was some sort of strategy on his part, which I really have trouble believing that as well, it was a very bizarre one.
It was bizarre indeed, but there is some of that old guard, new guard mentality.
Well, that's, I think, the context of the whole discussion this week was that there was a context for this, which is there's an old civil rights guard, and Jesse Jackson is seen as being the leader of that, and a new generation, and Obama is seen as being the leader of that, and that's the context in which this debate took place.
At 5 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And yesterday, the funeral for former White House Press Secretary Tony Snow was held. How's he going to be remembered, Jerry?
I think well. I think fondly by both. I mean, he crossed the divide between journalism and government service, and I think made very few enemies in either place, really. And I think in terms of his service at the White House, I think he was seen as injecting more life, more information, and more humor all at the same time into White House briefings, which can be dreary and antagonistic and unpleasant unless there's a certain amount of both information and humor that comes from the podium, and Tony provided some of both.
Karen?
I agree. This does not make him any less of an advocate for the president's interests, because he was absolutely ardent and, in fact, was a rock star in Republican fundraising circles, which was something that we'd never seen before.
Very unusual.
But I think most people who dealt with him on a personal level do remember him for both humor and grace.
Amen.
Well, I think you're going to see some pressure on future White Houses to bring in people behind that podium who bring a similar kind of star power and fame to the job. In the past, that's been a staff job. You know, you have young people who are fairly anonymous, briefing the press. And now we see you can bring in somebody famous who's got a bit of a celebrity, and they can push the president's message a little bit harder than
but
just a
staff
person.
But you've got to have that loyalty and the promise not to write books afterwards, perhaps. I wonder if longtime listeners to the program recall that Tony Snow actually made his broadcast debut on this very program on the Friday News Roundup. He was one of our very, very first panelists, always came in so well informed, so light, so easy in his remarks. He was a dear, dear man. I send my condolences to his wife and family. I know how hard it must be for them. Thanks for the Friday News Roundup. Eamon Jabbers, Jerry Seib, Karen Tumulty. Karen, stay safe as you travel. Thanks for listening, all. Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.